Station number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W. Waitman, Reel 12.
Colonel W. A. Waitman, Reel 12. What was the terrain like that you are now moving through, Colonel?
Undulating. On the south bank of the Irrawaddy. And having captured Zalokpa village, spent two or three days there, we pulled back within the Irrawaddy bridgehead and dug into our respective foxholes. I was sent for by the adjutant, Captain John Steele, who informed me that my father put in a case through two members of parliament to say that he needed me to run the farm back at Middle Herrington. I told Captain Steele that I had two brothers back at home and that within the foxholes and slit trenches round about where we were chaps that I was going to have to live with after the war. And without being brave in any sense of the word, I said that I was going to stay where I was and carry on. And in no way was I going to apply to get out of the army, let alone the 14th Army. And it just sounded so farcical. There we were, the Irrawaddy bridgehead, fighting our 14th Army, fighting the Japanese 15th Army, and anything administrative like that seemed so, to use a more modern expression, which didn't know then, way out. But I'd say that then we would say so wide of the mark. I told John Steele I would have to live with these chaps after the war. And I'm pleased to say that a lot of us did live and met up after the war and still do meet up. So I was going to stay exactly where I was. And I went back to my foxhole and carried on.
Did you ever discover how your father took this refusal when it got back to him?
I didn't know, but I still have a letter from him. And he, having been hostile in 1943 to me joining the army and going off to the war, he really supported me and appreciated the fact that I'd done this. And he sent me, thinking that I'd have mess bills. This was the reason he did it. He sent me £100 when I was in India and £100 when I was in Burma to pay my mess bills. The fact that we were living like threadbare and penniless, it didn't enter into it at all. But that money, that £200 he sent in two separate instalments, went to the Imperial Bank of India, and that was it. And I was still living out of the money I'd won on the mule gym car at Hallador 6 weeks previously, or whatever it was. But I'm very pleased to say that before he died, several months later, my father appreciated that I was doing what a lot of millions of other boys were doing, and some ladies, some girls, getting stuck in to help to win the war. Just one small little bit.
So what happened next?
Well, then 6th Brigade started to break out the Irrawaddy Bridgehead, and the brigade opened up the Royal Welsh Fusiliers going ahead, and they tackle the Japanese on a position called the Thumb and the Pimple. And the Royal Berkshires, the Royal Welsh, went ahead. The Durham's in reserve. And C Company, with the 2DLI, were following close behind the Royal Welsh. And I took over a position from Colonel Stocker, who gave me a complete brief on where his chaps were, where the Japanese were. And we watched the Berkshires, supported by a troop of tanks, go into an attack very, very slowly, trying to roll up this Japanese position. Anyway, a Jap anti-tank gun was in a Burmese hut, dug in low down, and hit and knocked out a tank. But then it was knocked out itself. And one stage, I saw some Royal Berkshire infantry running around rather frightened and scared. Learnt later that one of them had stopped one of these anti-tank rounds all to himself. And having received a direct hit, his body was splattered over the rest of the section, which rather unnerved them. But they pressed on and overran the Japs. And we then moved forward. And after covering about a couple of miles, were laid behind the village of Malajin, which covered the motorable track to Myotha. We weren't sure whether Malajin was held or not, but we advanced as far as we could for that particular day. And Colonel Tank Waterhouse decided that Malajin was his next objective. And that afternoon, late evening, I was tasked with the job of leaving the battalion at night and going round behind Malajin village to see whether it was held or not. And if it was held, report it as held, and then the battalion would attack it. And then we'd cross the Myotha Road. So I did my reconnaissance very, very thoroughly on foot, and I knew the ground very well. So once darkness had fallen, I set off my platoon, left the battalion position, and moved round clockwise from the battalion, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. And in the very early hours, got up to a line of palm trees, roughly 11 o'clock, of the village of Malajin. And this was the night, 10th, 11th of March, 1945. I then left the platoon at the line of palm trees, and with three men, Private John McCall, known as Blundy McCall, Pip Pearson from Easington, and Morgan Jones from Middlesbrough, the four of us went forward. And we suspected that there were Japanese or Burmans in the village, because we could hear either chopping or digging going on. But we hadn't actually seen any of them or been fired at. So I stayed there with Corporal Pearson and sent McCall and Jones back to bring the rest of the platoon up, under my platoon sergeant, Frank Rushford. Frank from Durham City was from a Durham City family, and he was sub-editor of the Durham County Advertiser. And we must have waited about half an hour for them to come up to us. And I must say, it rather felt like half a year when there's just two of you on your own. It's Burma, Japanese, wherever they are. It's a lonely old place. And they came up great. Then, within an hour, still in the semi-darkness, the company came in, up in the major shuttle. And he said, we must go further forward. So I led the way, and I'd gone about another 100 yards. And by this time, daylight was breaking, and I saw a chap walk towards us in a hurry. And he was dressed, not in Jap Army uniform, but mixed dress, is all I could say. And I said, who's this fella? And the major said, get a section in, quick. And he ran, scarped, back. This chap dived into the hedge and popped out the other side. So we started fire at him. He ran for his life. And obviously he was Japanese, although that was not apparent at that time. He could have been a Burman. And retrospectively, I realised that when I first saw him, he'd just been having a Jimmy Riddle. He was fussing his fly buttons. We hit him twice, and he ran for his life and dropped twice. And McCall, Pearson, and Corporal Gardner chased him. And they were about 20 yards behind him. We were all firing at him. I think I probably hit him in the ricochet when he dropped the first time. He kept going, and falling flat, so obviously somebody was tickling him up. And McCall and Pearson were in front, Gardner was behind. And suddenly a grenade went off in front of Corporal Gardner. And he ran through the smoke and dusted the grenade and shot at a position in the hedge. Then he came back. I was controlling my other two sections, making sure we held this bit of high ground within 20 yards of the village of Malajin, because we were on the high ground. And we realised that this chap who'd run for it was their grenade discharger man, because he'd left the grenade discharger and all his grenades behind and legged it. And Gardner staggered back to me and said, I'm wounded, sir. And he undid his trousers and he was peppered across from the navel downwards with these small splinters from the Japanese grenade, which tend to powderize into small pieces. And I said, well, you're not badly hurt, Corporal Gardner. Go back to Corporal Campbell and then get back if you can. I wasn't to know that he was to die of the wound 3 days later. But I yelled to Pearson McCall, behind you, behind you. And they stopped and both came back either side of this hedge that ran down the reverse slope of the position that we'd jumped, and there were two Japanese in this foxhole, one of whom had been killed by Gardner. And Pearson put his rifle up to finish the other one off, and I can see it now, his number 4 rifle, which was a sniper rifle, the bolt head going forward, click, and no round going off because his rifle was empty. He jumped back like a scalded cat and put another clip of 5 into his rifle. But McCall just stepped forward, and from the range of about 1 foot, went bup, 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 and the Japanese was no more. Whereupon, shooting was going on from the edge of the village. And we returned their fire, and we got down on this high ground, 20-30 yards from the village, in what was 2 sunken footpaths, rather like World War I trenches. And we waited there for about an hour till a troop of tanks came up. And the major said, right, Bill, you've been front platoon, cap to the top of the position. You can be rear platoon now, 11th platoon, 9th platoon, go forward. And while we were waiting, two Japanese machine guns, we didn't know there were two, that could have been one, kept firing in our direction whenever they felt like it, to try to suss us out. But we were lucky, it didn't hit anybody. But I remember lying with another platoon commander on the left-hand side of a hedge, and down below in the sunken track was Tweddle from Stanley, company runner, an ex-coal miner. And the bullets were obviously going through the hedge. And whilst you can't see them, you could see the bits of leaf falling off. And Tweddle would just look up quite nonchalantly and, you know, wonder what was happening, not knowing that it was about 2 foot of his maker. And, okay, Jack Dyer and I were sort of looking at this, I particularly because I was the nearest, and the fact that I was probably 2 or 3 feet from my maker was entirely incidental, but it was just part of life's rich pattern. Anyway, the trooper tanks came up, and they really brassed the village up under the squadron commander, Desmond Murphy, great guy. Desmond always commanded his tank with his head looking out the top and tell the driver where to drive and the gunner where to aim and whatever. And they really gave this edge of this village a good stoking up. Anyway, we advanced. And the two platoons in front didn't enter the village. They just skirted the edge. Fortunately, I saw a Jap put his head up on my left. And I merely said, as if it was an exercise, "Corporal Inch, third tree from the right, bang in front of you, Japanese position." Corporal Inch, John McCall, Blondie McCall, Pearson, Jones just ambled forward and took it out. And McCall got the two machine gunners, and one of them is the Japanese machine gun in the Akeley Heads Museum now. Now, Inch picked one of them up and walked towards me, ambling, and said, "Here it is, sir," and threw it towards me. And that machine gun is the one in Akeley Heads. And Pearson told me afterwards that the Japs were a bit punch drunk through the tank 75mm, really stoking it up. And this nip with one of the machine guns came out of his position a bit. He must have thought Pentagon was firing the wrong way. They came up. McCall was just standing behind him. And he said, "You could see the holes going in his jacket, sir." Anyway, a Buddhist priest scuttled across the smoke and the flames, because by this time of the tank fire, the village was well and truly ablaze, or the corner we were attacking. And I could hear Corporal Binns of 11th Platoon shouting, "Don't shoot, don't shoot." It's a priest or something like that. But all the Bourbons had left, so he would either be a Japanese sympathiser or a Jap dressed up as a Buddhist priest. And he was obviously winged by one of the tanks. Because when we went down the side of the village, we saw this Buddhist priest propped up against a tree about 50 yards away. And McCall, just up with his Bren gun, brrrr, gave him a burst. And Pip Pearson, Fred, his proper name, just went bang, reloaded, bang, and turned to me and said, "I put two through him, sir." And he had done, because he was there the next day, stiff as a plank. So the village was cleared, and we sat on the position. But whilst we were doing so, a Jap artillery piece, I would think a 75mm or whatever, opened up, open sights, bang! Bang! Straight into us. And we lay down in one of the sunken footpaths, as I said earlier, like a World War I trench. And I always remember looking up, and a palm tree that had been in front of us was no longer there, it was flat. But he was zeroing in on the track junction, and with one of his shots, he got Corporal Inch and McCall both wounded. And Jones and Pearson took McCall's boot and putty off, and I could see the slash across John McCall's boot. And at that time, Achilles tendon was a very, very dodgy operation orthopaedic-wise. I thought, oh, God, I hope it hasn't cut that. He would have a club foot the rest of his life. And when they got his sock off, you could actually see his Achilles tendon, but it wasn't cut. And Inch was edging along on his backside with a nice bit of red blood showing on his thigh or backside. And I thought, rather like Charlie Husband had said a fortnight earlier, or rather Joe Davis had said to Charlie Husband, you jabby bastard, you've got a right good one there, you're back and back to India. So they went out wounded. And we stayed on that position and held it. But it was amusing, firing at this Japanese that was running. And then I saw another Jap who'd run away. And he went into a hedge in the valley bottom. And I had a shot at him. And I saw my shot strike in the field behind him, probably about 5 yards from him. And he got out like a dose of salts and scooted further. And when we got among their kit the next day, we looked at various photographs and things, personal effects. An American Japanese came and checked with us about a week or 10 days later, and we showed him the photograph of this Japanese officer with his sword, whatever, and he said that was Colonel Torikai. Colonel Torikai, commanding 138 Infantry Regiment, and that's who you're up against, one of his platoons. But we'd seen them off. And again, they were tending to run, which was the second time we'd seen them run. Very heartening.
In actions such as you've described, Colonel, there will be men that you recommended for medals for what they did?
In the Irrawaddy, in the attack on Sandy Ridge, I strongly recommended Corporal Potts, who came across from 11th Platoon and crossed my platoon's axis of advance when the rest of the platoon, when the platoon commander was wounded and the batman killed, did nothing. And Potts got a military medal. And I verbally, there was no time to write anything down, I verbally gave McCall a big write-up, verbal build-up to Major Shuttle. And I think he might have got a mention in dispatches. But when I went to see him after the war with Margaret Louise Craven, he wasn't in at home when we called to see him at Waterville Road, North Shields. But he joined us in Malaya, and we were friends for life. But Louis Craven and I went over there in 1946, but he was out. We met his mother.
Were the Japanese leaving rather unpleasant booby traps for you?
The odd mine on tracks where they were trying to get a jeep, because we had only one 30-hundredweight per company, so we had very, very little transport. Unlike the Germans, who had shoe mines and booby traps and whatever in Italy and Europe.
The terrain, you said, was undulating now. Was this helping you in the way that you were moving and
Well, we were
fighting?
Going from village to village and hilltop to hilltop, and then driving for the Mandalay Rangoon Road. We crossed a tributary of the Irrawaddy at a village called Yawathit. There's Yawathit East and Yawathit West. And when we waded the river at one of the Yawathits, I just forget whether it was the east or west, we were laid having a sleep that night. And a Japanese machine gun thought he'd have a dig at the village and put a burst in, which just perchance struck right beside Sergeant Rushford, my platoon sergeant, and Jeff Cooper, my runner, and myself. And in the cold of the night, heard these bullets strike and the shots. You hear the shots afterwards, obviously. We rolled into the foxhole, and I thought Cooper was killed. And with the cold and the shock and the fright, I literally heard my own teeth chatter. And I'm not ashamed to say so, and I've often told people that, when you get caught out like that, you get one hell of a fright. We were sleeping on a bit of raffia matting that an Indian, a Tamil, who lived in this Burmese village, had given us to sleep on, as opposed to the soil. It just made that little bit of difference, a little bit of extra warmth.
Which of the Japanese weaponry did you have the greatest respect for?
Well, we were always wary of their mortars. But, like any infantry, the light machine gun is always a very, very deadly weapon. And that accounted for my two chaps in Tongyong on the 30th of December, Corporal Ted Lindsay and Private George Hitchens. And they were good shots with their rifles because everything was rather close range. Even out of the jungle, you're at close quarters in villages or the approach to the villages.
Were you getting automatic weapons other than the Bren?
We had our Brens. Each section had a Bren gun. And on breaking out the Irori bridgehead, I don't know where I got it from. It might have been from another platoon that was short, because we're getting short on men. But I had four Bren guns, four light machine guns, in about, 40 to 15 men strong platoon, because the fact that you got the firepower there. And our best weapon for defence, of course, was the 2nd Manchester, 2nd Battalion Manchester Regiment, which we called Doe Manch, Doe being the Urdu for the for two. And if you had them in your position, you knew that you could stop them because you got the belt fed. Because
you hadn't got Stens or that kind of weapon.
The second commanders carried Stens. But we weren't too keen on them because, as I mentioned earlier, when we crossed the Irrawaddy, crossed the Chinwin, you only had to give one a bump and it fed and fired. So the Sten was not too popular a weapon.
Did you carry a revolver?
I carried a revolver, but kept it out of sight under my mess tins. Because if you had a map or a binoculars or revolver, an obvious target, I carried a rifle. And it was a good rifle. But I can only say that with that rifle, I only hit that one on Sandy Ridge on the way up. But he was my first. And like your first girlfriend, it's one you remember.
Did the tactics that you used, Colonel, vary depending upon the objective and the type of terrain you were fighting over?
Invariably, a presumed attack, two sections up with one covering fire, or two advancing in the attack and the third section in reserve. And that was platoon-wise, and then company-wise, one platoon left, one platoon right, and the third platoon in the rear. But going back again to the break, the initial enlarging the Irrawaddy bridgehead on the 27th of February, that was a two-battalion attack, a brigade attack. The Royal Berkshires left, two companies up, and the Durhams on the right, two companies up. C Company left, D Company right, and then when they got engaged in the Palms, after about a mile, B Company came up, so it was C and B that took Sandy Ridge. But Sandy Ridge was largely captured by 10 platoon. And Sergeant Major Welsh came up the following morning and said to my lads, "You went up that ridge like a fighting platoon," which they did.